From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the White Power Movement. This is a collection of very different people from all over the country who had radical ideas about race and the government. The historian Kathleen Belew calls it a social movement, and she traces it to those years just after the war in Vietnam, where soldiers and others came to believe they couldn't trust their government anymore. The movement developed a structure that turned rhetoric into real violence. Join us after this. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and our latest short on Radio West Films has the comedian Aaron Woodall breaking down his favorite joke. It was something difficult he'd been wanting to say to an audience at BYU, something about going on a mission. And it was one of those jokes that he had to land just right, but saying what he had to say, it could be a tough crowd. Go see the film at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're going to have to keep reminding ourselves throughout the hour that Kathleen Belew is an historian, not a political pundit. Her work and her latest book is the result of her analyzing the historical record, the archival material, to explain this story of the White Power movement that emerged in the 1970s and then culminated in the devastating bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. It's going to be tempting to draw parallels about the movement then and whatever version of the movement that exists today. And Belew is very careful about that. But in her book, she says what is inescapably clear is that the lack of public understanding about how the movement was born and how it worked left this opening for white power activism to live on. There is a serious threat of bloodshed in this kind of activism. And so knowing how these ideas take hold, she says, can provide some context and even prevent some future violence. Her book is called Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement in Paramilitary America. Kathleen Belew is joining us today. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. And she's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station WBEZ in Chicago. Kathleen Belew, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin on when did you first start thinking about, like, was there a moment, an event, something that you came across as you were, and when you first started thinking about this that really got you started on the idea for the book?
You know, I wanted to write something about Truth and Reconciliation Commissions because it was clear to me as I began graduate school that there's a legacy of racial inequality and racial violence in the United States that we have not addressed fully in this country. And there was such a commission in Greensboro, North Carolina in 2005 that sought to sort of unpack the shooting of leftist demonstrators by Klan and neo-Nazi gunmen there in 1979. And in this commission, the people who were affiliated with Klan and neo-Nazi groups would show up to give their testimony, which is an interesting thing in itself since this commission had no subpoena power.
Yeah. But
people wanted to tell their story. And over again, their narrative of the event included something along the lines of, well, I shot communists in Vietnam. Why wouldn't I shoot communists in North Carolina? This struck me as enormously important because it shows a collapse of time between the Vietnam War and its aftermath, a collapse of space because the battle lines and the home front become indistinguishable, and also a collapse of different kinds of enemies because we're talking about in North Carolina the shooting deaths of Americans, four white men and one African-American woman, as opposed to, enemy combatants in Vietnam. And as I got into the archive, which you referenced in the introduction, which is a huge archive of primary source materials, that idea was central to an enormous amount of movement discourse. And it came up over and over again, and that's what sort of led me into this project.
I want to say a little bit more about that truth and reconciliation process. I find it really fascinating that, as you said, there was no subpoena power, but that people especially in that white power movement, wanted to tell their story. I'm wondering what you make of that. I mean, they were more than willing to tell the story. And what does that indicate? I mean, it didn't seem like it was just a kind of rhetoric that they wanted to say. It seems like they felt like they had a beef that they wanted to express or something.
Sure. I think that part of it has to do with this narrative of the Vietnam War, which is a phenomenon that is much broader than the white power movement. And let me be clear that what I'm talking about is a narrative of the Vietnam War. And indeed, the people that I'm writing about in this book are not all Vietnam veterans. And those that are represent a tiny, probably not even a statistically significant percentage of returning veterans as a group. But the Vietnam War as a story did a lot of important things in the aftermath of that conflict, mostly during the 1980s. One of them has to do with a narrative that was really deeply felt, not only by people who served, but by many other people, that the government had somehow prevented victory or betrayed soldiers. And you see this narrative all over the place. It's in every popular film about the Vietnam War, basically, especially in the 1980s. It's in memoirs. It's in sort of pop culture novels and portrayals of the conflict. But the importance of this narrative for the people that I'm looking at is that it allows a perception of the government that is militant, that allows a revolutionary turn, and it allows a separation of what the actors in my study would see as patriotism from support of the government itself. This is a bit of a jump, but the idea is that the support of the army or the nation can pull apart from the support of the federal government such that people can think that they are working in a way that feels deeply meaningful and deeply, deeply patriotic to them, but is actually oriented towards a revolutionary race war that seeks to displace the state.
This seems like the biggest distinction between these racist, white nationalist, racist movements before the Vietnam War. I mean, they were about, it seemed like anyway, very much talked about patriotism, those kinds of things. And so that idea of wanting to overthrow the government, this revolutionary idea, seems to be the biggest significant shift from that, I guess.
That's absolutely right. So if you think about prior surges in Klan membership, for instance, they are almost always oriented towards supporting the state and supporting the status quo. So most famously, the Klan in the 1920s, which is also the largest surge of the Ku Klux Klan, was parading on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., wearing robes and hoods but no masks. You can see this archival photo in the National Archives. It's free. You can search it yourself. And it's a large number of people parading in public as Klansmen. And it's sort of emblematic of how the second Klan really was mainstream, really was sort of a social club, even as it was carrying out racist violence. It was also, you know, the rhetoric was about being 100% American and keeping out people who are not 100% American.
Yeah.
The movement that I study has this notable shift in 1983 where strategies change, rhetoric changes, and it's enabled by the Vietnam War story, but it really is to advocate for race war and overthrow of the government. Part of this is brought about by a strategy called leaderless resistance, which is what we would now understand as cell-style terrorism, the idea that people can work in groups of 1 to 6 to 12 in organized cells to carry out acts that are designed to bring about race war without any contact with leadership.
Yeah. That idea, we'll get back to this because I think it's the idea of having a structure, even though people don't seem to think of it as structured. But it is and was, and that will get us to Timothy McVeigh and his story a little bit later on the program. I want to back up just a bit. One of the things that you mentioned early on, and this is kind of an important theme, you say white power, when you mention it, you're referring to a social movement. And the idea that this is a social movement seems that I thought that was so interesting. Talk a little bit about that, because this is an important idea here, that these are that this movement is flexible, it's kind of diverse. I mean, they have common ideas, but that the fact that it's a social movement seems really important.
Yes, it's incredibly important. There are a lot of misconceptions about these kinds of actors. And missing the piece of white power as a social movement is what allows us to continue thinking about these acts as the work of madmen or lone wolves, when in fact they're connected both by an ideology and by a robust social network of people. So the white power movement, one of the things that the Vietnam War did was create a mechanism for unifying groups that previously had been fighting with one another. That doesn't mean there wasn't infighting or kind of personality-driven conflict. Certainly both of these things were present throughout the movement, as in, I think, every social movement, especially of the latter 20th century. But the Vietnam War allowed unification between, for instance, neo-Nazis and Klansmen. Now, if you think about the aftermath of World War II, those two groups had a very difficult time getting in the same room. And I have people talking about this in the archive about how for people who served in World War II, Klansmen who served in World War II, being in a room full of swastikas meant something very, very poignant and objectionable. Yeah. But in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, there's a sense of emergency that brings these two groups together. And they also were able to recruit a whole bunch of new people who had not been really unified into this groundswell or into previous surges of the Klan quite in the same way. This included a very broad variety of radical tax protesters, of skinheads, especially in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and eventually would incorporate the militia movement as sort of an outgrowth of this activity in the late 80s, early 90s.
I found it interesting, too, that that war and just the way war works with weapons and uniforms and marching, that seemed to be an important structure to get these people collected together, because you see uniforms and you see these paramilitary groups and you see weaponry and chanting and marching and those same kinds of things. So was this one of the things that they could organize themselves around, is this idea of, I don't know, I guess military is the way to put it.
Yes, exactly. So backing up to sort of the broad importance of the Vietnam War, we talked about the narrative of betrayal. That's one thing. We talked about the mechanism of alliance, which is another. But the third, as you point out, is sort of the instrumental and material impact of the Vietnam War on this movement. It provided the weapons, the tactics, the uniforms, the ideology. And you see this everywhere from I have a photograph of a Klan member wearing a Klan robe, but made out of camouflage fatigue material. Mm-hmm. So literally it transfigures the Klan robe and hood. And then there are also just neo-Nazis, Klansmen, radical tax resistors. Everyone begins to outfit themselves in camo fatigues to use the weapons and material left over from the Vietnam War and sometimes even stolen from military armories, and to use sort of the performative and narrative frame of the Vietnam War to structure both targets and strategies for achieving the goals of the movement.
Can I just ask, I get how these groups would feel betrayed by the government, that their sacrifice had been trivialized and politicized. But how does that get to the basic question of racism? Because it seems like you have this groundwork, a couple of things going on that I wanted you to talk about. Race is one of them, but then there are these other things like there was legislation at the time that was increasing immigration. You had civil rights. You had women's rights. You also point out people are losing factory jobs, losing farms as well. So there's an economic part to this story. So all these factors seem to be converging.
Yeah, the historical context of the movement is really important, as you say. So the 1970s and 80s are a time of enormous shift and change, ranging from sort of the entirely cataclysmic shift of the American economy in the early 1970s, which really changes the ability of the state to follow through on the promises that it has made to all kinds of people. to the ramifications of the social movements that reshaped American society in the 50s and 60s. So in the 1970s, gender relationships are upended. Race relationships are upended. As you say, new immigration laws have brought in new groups of people. There are fleeing a flight of factory jobs and foreclosures that really threaten people's economic well-being. And there's also something more abstract, which is not just among people on the fringe, but through American society more broadly. There's this profound distrust in public institutions. This ranges from the state to religion to Congress to everything. It's a time of extreme breakage and distrust. So this sort of foments a moment where white power can get a recruitment momentum that will benefit the processes that I look at in the book. The other thing, just to go back to what you were asking about white power as a social movement, is we've been mostly talking about the paramilitary and outward-facing part of the movement. But actually, this is a movement that is across regions, across different kinds of space. So people are in cities and suburbs, in rural areas. People are in all regions of the country. It also bands together men, women, and children. And the women's activism is sort of how we see the apparatus that joins these groups with one another. Women are doing the important work of brokering social relationships, of intermarriages that stabilize intergroup alliances, and even things like holding summer picnics, sharing childcare, and providing material support to the movement. So all of that is coming together in the same moment to really put this forward as a social movement.
The idea of the movement being flexible, they were flexible in the way they adopted racist symbols and beliefs. And in that sense, they seemed really kind of organized or very pragmatic. I mean, if they wanted to accomplish these kinds of things, which was basically the overthrow of the government and some kind of race war, they knew they had to create these alliances, it seems like. I mean, it seems quite structured, quite organized.
Yes. And here they're really taking a page from earlier Ku Klux Klan strategy, which has been very opportunistic. So going back to that example of the Klan in the 1920s, the second era Klan, many people have a conception of the Klan as anti-black, and certainly it was. But the second era Klan was also anti-Mexican in Texas and near the U.S.-Mexico border. It was anti-labor in the Pacific Northwest, where there was a big labor movement. It was anti-Catholic in Indiana, where there was a large population of Catholics around Notre Dame. It was anti-immigrant in the urban Northeast, where there was a large population of immigrants. So the Klan has always mobilized around whatever the local hatreds are in order to gain members and create a sort of upsurge of activity. That's an old play.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things going on in the period of my study is that opportunism is even more intense because of how deeply worried people are about the sense of the apocalyptic future.
Yeah.
And this is operating both at the level of religious belief and at the level of fear of racial annihilation. So many of the beliefs held in common within the white power movement that also appear in mainstream conservatism at the same moment, four white power activists have an element of fear of racial extinction. So things like opposing abortion, opposing LGBT rights, opposing immigration, opposing birth control, but also favoring the right of what they call free association in the period of my study, which is effectively continued segregation. Mm-hmm. For them, all of those issues are understood to be connected with this threat to the future of white children, the birth of white children. So that's all connected and has this texture of deep, deep emergency rhetoric, the feeling of apocalyptic end. And the more people feel that way, I've seen in this archive, the more they are willing to sort of expand the parameters of what they think activism could look like. So, for instance, white power leadership has meetings where they discuss how to sort of, how to appeal to skinheads who present a very dramatic cultural shift for the movement. Skinheads in the period of the study are tattooed. Mm-hmm. They cut their hair short. The women wear makeup and sometimes go topless. All of this is a striking contrast to the social mores held by kind of old line white power activists. Skinhead women, don't wear skirts. The men drink alcohol and do drugs. All of these things are not okay with some of the other major power centers within the movement. But there's a sort of intentional conversation around, we need these people. We need to figure out how to incorporate them.
Yeah. I think I know you're careful about this, and so I'm not. I promise I'm not going to try to keep bringing this back to the future or the present. But it is tempting, as I said in the introduction, not to see those parallels or talk about them. Immigration questions, clearly questions about civil rights and race relations today, even women's rights, even the economic factors playing out that had an impact on the 2016 election. What can you, and there's not archival material for you to make conclusions, but clearly you can say, oh, I don't know. What can you say, I guess, about what you're seeing now? And then we can move on, because I want to get back to the history, but we should say something about that, because I know people are thinking about it.
I think that the question, the thing that I hope this book could do is to offer us some ideas about how history can show us how to learn from the past, that the story of how this went before might show us some things about what we could do better in the present moment. In many ways, what seems new and shocking about our current moment is not new, and the history is what shows us how that is true. So, for instance, the altercation of alt-right protesters and others at Charlottesville last August is very, very much like Greensboro, where we see a coalition of overtly racist groups coming to blows with anti-racist activists. The way that the Greensboro shooting was handled has things to offer us about how we educate juries, how we think about a fair trial, what mechanisms have been effective at stopping white power organizing and what have not. Mm-hmm. And all of these things have direct bearing on the present moment. So that said, you're absolutely right that there is no archive that I can draw from in the present moment. And even if I wanted to extend past 1995, the kind of archival base that allows the kind of analysis that I give in this book won't be available for another, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when it is, will probably require a scholar who speaks several languages and is adept at computer code and things like this that
right.
that probably extend beyond my expertise.
Yeah.
So,
we can say this, and this was interesting, that the Oklahoma City bombing, and we'll come back to this a little bit later in the program, but you say the Oklahoma City bombing did not solidify a public understanding of the white power movement and its potential for violence. And you say the fact that it didn't is remarkable. So we're not really learning the lesson, I guess, is the point.
That's right. The Oklahoma City bombing represents the largest mass casualty event, deliberate mass casualty event on American soil between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. But compared to those other events, we've spent remarkably little sort of collective time and energy understanding what it meant and why it happened and the real ideology and social movement organizing that underlay that action. It's largely still described as the work of one or a few people. It's often still held up as an example of lone wolf violence. And usually Timothy McVeigh is not understood as part of a movement, even though there is clear evidence now that he was and that he was shaped by and acting within a worldview that is reprehensible to me, but understandable. We can get into the archive and understand the reasons for that action. I think that a similar thing is true of Greensboro, which is another sort of, at the time, it was a shocking event. It was covered on the front page of many national newspapers. It was covered on morning news magazine shows. Greensboro even became the subject of a Saturday Night Live sketch. But I was speaking for myself when I encountered it in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's not an event I was familiar with. And I think a lot of people don't know that story, even though it's such a clear historical cognate for Charlottesville, and even though it's in the recent past. So part of what I'm trying to look at here is the mechanism of forgetting, the mechanism of occlusion that we knew about this movement. All of the events I write about in this book were covered by newspapers and major media when they happened, but we didn't have the mechanism for putting them together to understand what we were looking at.
It's Kathleen Belew. Her book is Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement in Paramilitary America. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER is working harder than ever to tell Utah stories with podcasts. You can take Doug Fabrizio's thoughtful Radio West interviews wherever you go, see how deep our reporters' work goes with more to say, and keep up with Utah politics on 45 Days. Listen to the stories you love on your own time, and we'll keep you up to date about new projects, too. Search for KUER wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the White Power Movement. This is a collection of very different people from all over the country who had radical ideas about race and the government. The historian Kathleen Belew calls it a social movement, and she traces it to those years just after the war in Vietnam, where soldiers and others came to believe they couldn't trust their government anymore. This movement developed a kind of command structure that turned rhetoric into real violence. Her book is called Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement in Paramilitary America. And Kathleen Belew is joining us from the studios of NPR, member station WBEZ in Chicago. I want to come back to this Vietnam war narrative. And we have to talk about one person in particular, at least, Louis Beam. Tell us a little bit about Beam. He was a gunner in the Vietnam War, and I think he's an important figure here.
So Louis Beam was a helicopter gunner on a Huey helicopter for two tours in Vietnam. And during that time, he experienced a traumatic war.
Yeah.
He wrote about his experiences, and he also had enough exposure that the archive can verify his experience, which is not true of every person in the movement who claims to be a veteran. But we do know some things about Beam. He wrote a very influential collection called Essays of a Klansman that was published in 1983 and then again in 1989. And one of the pieces in that book is actually where I find the title for Bring the War Home. Yeah. He has an essay called Vietnam, Bring It On Home. And in that piece, he's directly calling for people in the White Power movement to restage the Vietnam War in the United States. He asks them to let civilians and government officials and others who he sees as not having supported Vietnam veterans, to let them experience the war for themselves, to make the American home front in the aftermath of Vietnam a war zone for white power.
You mentioned he wasn't you say the war did not, of course, make him racist. He had expressed this white supremacy sentiment before all of that. So how does the idea of race and his racism, how does that play out in the context of the war?
You know, this is one of the really interesting things about Louis Beam's writings. He's very persuasive, and he's tapping into a narrative that is one can empathize with the many parts of what he's talking about. So I actually use his essays often for teaching with undergraduates because he begins with a very humane sort of frame about the violence of warfare and the horror of combat and the many people he has seen killed and kind of the way that it feels, that the Vietnam War felt to him to be meaningless, to be directed by people who seem totally unsympathetic, sort of the things that we as historians know very well from the literature of the Vietnam War. Mm. And then he'll pivot midway through or near the end of the essay and suddenly be talking about, and this is why, he will argue, one must fight to secure a future for white children. And all of a sudden, you're finding yourself in a very different set of ideology, ideological claims. So for the undergraduates, it's really interesting to figure out where to put historical empathy when you get to that last section of the paper. But I think that Beam is such an effective figure because he's able to mobilize this common sense of frustration, this common affect around the failed war and betrayal and this very real sense of being wronged that's actually so widespread that it goes far beyond veterans. Many people can get into this narrative. And he's able to use this very effectively to bring people into the movement.
I find it so interesting that you would think that war, being at war, being in combat, being in solidarity with other soldiers of color would have made people like Lewis Beam less racist. But you write about how Ku Klux Klan membership seems to, I think, certainly after the Civil War, for example, it surges. And I guess that makes some sense. But Vietnam makes less sense to me in that sense, how it would be that these racist ideologies would surge after these moments of war. Do you think you understand it at this point?
So let me pull apart a couple of different pieces of that question. First, what you're describing in Vietnam does happen on a large scale, where people fighting together do make alliances and very deep friendships across racial lines that last after the war. And I think we see the fruits of that coming home in all kinds of different ways. Vietnam veterans are an enormous part of the civil rights movement, the women's liberation movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement. I could go on.
Yeah.
And also many leftist groups use those alliances to sort of paramilitarize in the other direction. And I talk about that a little bit in the book as well. But I think what we've thought about less is how warfare and the stress of combat can also retrench things. So the rear echelon of Vietnam was highly segregated. Lewis Beam's camp was highly segregated. He hung a Confederate flag in his barracks, and he's not the only one. There's a record of a racial clash in the rear echelon at Vietnam, in boot camps in the United States during the Vietnam War and afterward. So this isn't a time of sort of unproblematic integration of the army. It's also the first war where the integrated army is really fully tested. Mm. So there's a lot of stresses that haven't been resolved. So there's that. I don't have the archival base to understand people's individual psychological journeys in this project. So I can't tell you exactly why Lewis Beam becomes a racist or when exactly that happens. I have evidence that it's before he enlists, but there are all kinds of ways that the war might deepen that feeling. Hmm. What I'm really looking at here is the way that the war creates a opportunity for activism and creates and escalates the impact of that paramilitary movement after warfare. So this is the part that has sort of a longer historical arc. What the record shows is that the surges, if you look just at surges in the Ku Klux Klan, which we have a nice long arc of time we can look at and many different kind of contextual change points, the closest correlation with membership surges of the Ku Klux Klan is with the aftermath of warfare. That's more consistent than with anti-immigration, with simple economic hardship. So to take one example, the Klan sort of bottoms out during the Great Depression, which we wouldn't expect if it was just about poverty.
Yeah.
It's more consistent than kind of moments of racial progress. It's more consistent than several other factors. So what do we do with that?
That is the question, isn't it? Fascinated to know why that would be.
Well, let me say one other thing, which is in the research, you might think, aha, it's just returning veterans and there is an inherent cycle of violence. And I was wondering about that myself. But actually, the research has shown that this spike in violent activity is actually not just among veterans. It's across genders. It's across all age ranges of society. So what we're seeing is actually that there is an effect of repercussion of warfare that is not just people who fought, but that is through all sectors of American society in the aftermath of warfare. There is a cost of warfare. Or put a different way, war doesn't stay where we put it and even with whom we put it. War ricochets into other areas of American life.
Mm. War comes home.
War comes home.
Yeah. I want to ask about the religious component. This is really fascinating, too, because you say in the book that the movement's religious extremism was really important to its revolutionary character. How much of this was fueled by religious fervor or this Christian identity movement?
So Christian identity is a political theology that really takes hold in the movement around the same time. And it shares several things in common with a sort of broader evangelical groundswell that is rising quite dramatically across the 1980s and into the 90s. But Christian identity is different in several ways. First of all, there are several different strands, but it claims that white people are the true lost tribe of Israel, and that all other people, meaning Jewish people, people of color, are descended either from Satan or from animals, depending on which doctrine you're in. So the idea is that white people are really the people that belong to God, and it takes on sort of an apocalyptic imaginary because of its theological character. Now, very importantly, evangelicals in this time period typically believe in the rapture, or the idea that people who are believers will be peacefully transported from the earth to heaven before kind of the time of tribulations. Yeah. As part of the end times. Christian identity does not have that guarantee of safety.
Right. You're on your own, right?
Yeah, not only you're on your own. So the idea is that Christian identity believers have to rid the world of the non-faithful before Christ can return. Right. So Christian identity believers are supposed to be the foot soldiers of the end times. So that means different things to different activists. As we've discussed, all of these beliefs are flexible.
Yep.
But people interpret it either as a call to survivalism, meaning they've got to outlast the period of tribulation. So that means stockpiling food, figuring out how to make your own soap, figuring out how to do your own medical care, that kind of thing. Or it means stockpiling weapons and preparing to wage war, because people interpret this as a call to arms. Because again, the non-believers are everyone who is not white. So there's a way that the apocalyptic end times war gets muddled into the sort of guerrilla race war within the movement. And then the question of when exactly is the apocalypse is another place where this is aligning with larger concerns in the American public that go far beyond the white power movement. A lot of people think the apocalypse is either imminent or already happened in the 80s or the 90s. So this moment of when will be the call to arms is really up for grabs.
What happens in 1983? Because you say it's at this point the movement really begins to distinguish itself from other groups.
Yeah, 1983 is the turn against the state. So it's a moment when people, these activists have really been thinking about a possible war on the federal government for a while. But there's a series of coordinated steps in 1983. One of them is at the Aryan Nations World Congress in the summer of 1983, which is sort of a summer retreat and Congress of different parts of the movement. And this is the moment when they really take up leaderless resistance as a frame for activism, which is the cell-style terrorism frame. And it's also the moment when they take the movement online, onto kind of the proto-internet, so computer message boards that are encrypted and have to be accessed by a keyword.
This is Liberty Net.
Liberty Net, yeah. And this is not just lip service. They go on a so there's a group called The Order, which is stealing large amounts of money and also counterfeiting money. And they use a lot of that stolen money to distribute to groups around the country so that those groups can buy computers and go online. And Liberty Net includes everything from hit lists of people that might be targets to other movement objectives to sort of rhetorical movement messages to personal ads that are meant to to further cohere the social relationships of the movement itself.
Seems like the other dynamic that's interesting about this is that they at least some in this group held some hope out for Ronald Reagan. But you write about how his second term was a real disappointment for white power activists, and he was becoming too moderate. They seemed like it seems like they figured that electoral politics is just not going to help. That's not the way we should even go.
That's right. The people that were fans of Reagan the first time around in the movement are becoming more and more disillusioned into the second term. And I should say, too, that this is also not just the white power movement. There's a huge groundswell, especially among evangelicals, of people who are really unhappy with Reagan in the second term. I think Time magazine calls it the thunder on the right in 1983.
Yeah.
And it's people who think that Reagan is too moderate, that they want more of the campaign promises and more hardline conservative positions, especially on social issues like abortion, that are beginning to really galvanize people. And this is the thread that will take us into sort of the culture wars place in the early 1990s, which is another place where the white power ideology really hits into the mainstream.
Which gets us to that crescendo in 95, of course, of Oklahoma City, the bombing there, and Timothy McVeigh. But we should back up a bit, and I wanted to sort of have you say something about the Turner Diaries. This is one of those things that bound, it seems like anyway, the movement together, was this novel. You talk about how it provided a blueprint for this structure and for their action. Talk about the Turner Diaries.
So, yes. So it's a utopian novel or dystopian novel, depending on where you're sitting, about a world in which a white race war has succeeded. So it provides a blueprint of action. But for historians and for people who want to understand this kind of activism, it also provides the answer to a really important question, which is how in the world could people think that they could overthrow the state in this time period when the state had achieved, you know, this is a moment of state superpower, of incredible military power, of incredible armament and strength. So what the Turner Diaries is a way of thinking about guerrilla warfare that is designed not only to overthrow, not only to sort of problematize state power through picking at targets and particular people, but also an idea that there is a kind of guerrilla war that would awaken the broader white populace to rise up against the state and take the country back. Hmm. Now, just a note, I actually don't think the country is the way we should be thinking about how this actually comes together, because by the time of my study, white nationalism is actually not a great term for what we're looking at.
Right.
My actors envision a racial movement that's going to unite white people across the globe in transnational white power. So the nation is not really the category of what we're looking at, unless, as they do, you think of a white racial nation.
Yeah.
So I think white power is actually the best term for what we're talking about.
Back to that idea that it's incredibly flexible. They're
yes.
evolving, yeah.
Well, and that they're now, but increasingly after getting online with LibertyNet, and increasingly as those proto message boards become the internet proper, they're in contact with people in Canada and Europe and South Africa and Australia about this idea of a white world.
Let's talk about Timothy McVeigh. Mentioned he's born in a small town in New York. He's a quiet kid, always interested in guns. His mother, of course, leaves him when he's an adolescent. I think people know this story. How does he get caught up? And there's this impression, and I think it persists. This is something that you write about, that he's this lone figure. He even talked about not being really connected to a movement, even though you say it's clear that he was. How does he get caught up in this white power movement?
So this is an interesting thing, because part of the strategy of leaderless resistance, or what we would understand as cell-style organizing, is that its soldiers will disavow connections to a broader movement.
Yeah.
That's part of the strategy. That's designed to make it more difficult to prosecute. And it's had another effect, which is that it's made it very difficult for the public to understand what it is. So the idea with leaderless resistance was to stop prosecution and infiltration. But actually, I wonder if the more damaging effect has not been to undermine public knowledge of white power as a social movement. So with McVeigh, for instance, we know that he had some interest in white power activity when he was serving. There are reports of him having a white power T-shirt at one point on base, of correspondence with different groups, of reading a newspaper of a Klan group. And then after he washes out of special forces and leaves the military, McVeigh has a very rootless existence that nevertheless takes him nearer many different white power groups. So we see a sort of social geography that puts him in contact with a whole lot of people. He's on the gun show circuit. And before the bombing also has attempted contacts with several white power groups, including Elohim City, which is an identity compound, National Alliance, which is a neo-Nazi group, and several other people.
I have to say, just while you're on that point, Robert Millar, who founds this Elohim City in 1973, he's another really interesting character, I have to say, in the story.
Yes, he sort of disavows his ties with the violent parts of the white power movement, but nevertheless, at several points, is harboring people who are fleeing prosecution after white power violent acts. He also has a relationship through marriage with a group called the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, which is one that is part of an FBI sting at one point that uncovers that they were making their own hand grenades and doing weapons machining and things like this. The other thing about McVeigh is the structure of the violence itself. And part of what we have to do as historians of this kind of a movement is to look at the acts of violence to locate meaning. So in choosing the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, McVeigh chose a building that had been a target of this movement since 1983 by that same group, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord. He chose a building that one of the people in the Michigan militia movement that he stayed with while part of that group could draw from memory. That they were so preoccupied with this target, they could draw it from memory. He was connected to his strategy through the Turner Diaries, which he read and distributed on the gun show circuit. The Turner Diaries, again, was distributed throughout the movement. They had copies of it at the Bunkhouse of the Order, which is another white power terrorist group. They had distributed copies of it at the White Patriot Party, which is one in North Carolina. He's bound to this movement in many, many, many ways. The disavowal is part of the strategy.
Right.
So we have to sort of, you know, understand the strategy in order to understand how to read the thing he's saying about his action.
What did the bombing do for that sense of awareness that you write about of the white power movement? Because you say that it distorted it. And it may have even destroyed an awareness of it. And I want to know what you mean by that.
So for this, we have to go to the story of another court case, which is the prosecution of 13 white power activists and leaders for charges including seditious conspiracy in 1987-88. So that's a federal trial. And there is overwhelming evidence about seditious conspiracy. Many of the activists there had actually had written about wanting to carry out seditious conspiracy. The jury got to see two laundry hampers full of illegal weapons and materiel wheeled through the courtroom. And there are several things about that trial that cast doubt on its effectiveness, including two romantic relationships between defendants and jurors, and the exclusion of large amounts of evidence, particularly about Louis Beam, who was arrested while on the run in Mexico. And there were chain of custody problems with a lot of the things that were collected by Mexican authorities at the site of the arrest.
Yeah, it was kind of a disaster.
It was a huge disaster. And it was also a big public relations disaster because the federal government had used several sting operations and major plea bargains that let other people off the hook to try to make this prosecution happen. It didn't work out. So one of the results of this was that the FBI issued a memorandum that was found by Leonard Zuskind, who's a journalist who became a historian of this movement, that that the FBI would no longer try to prosecute white power violence as part of a movement. They were going to only prosecute individuals. That was the decision after the sedition trial. And, you know, this is also weighed upon by the major tragedies that are also huge public relations disasters for the DOJ at Waco and Roby Ridge, where right. we have the deaths of civilians in highly spectacular overreaches of state power. So by the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, there's this idea that we're trying to only prosecute McVeigh. Mm-hmm. This shapes the investigation, this shapes the prosecution, and this shapes the public understanding of what it is. We never see the story about the movement, even though that story is there.
Let me ask you this finally. We're almost out of time, but you write in the book that the movement has left these lasting marks on American politics and on popular culture. What are the lasting marks that you're seeing now, if you can say something about that finally?
I think it really is that what seems new and shocking in the present moment is not new. We have this history of similar activism, of this ideology, of these strategies. We have a story about this that we can use to understand what we're seeing. This is what we can learn from the past. This is how we can learn to do something different in our response to this violence today.
Kathleen Belew. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. Her book is Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement in Paramilitary America. Joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Professor, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.